Well, hello, grievers. Mandy here. Restorative grief is all about creating easy access to healing, no matter where or who you are. That's why I want you to remember that if you want grief support beyond a podcast, our Patreon features monthly workbooks to accompany each episode, as well as a Discord channel for more private chats and occasional bonus content as well. Supporting this work with your finances means investing in your own wellness and the healing of others, and that in itself is an incredibly generous and restorative practice. The link to the Patreon is in the show notes, but reach out with questions, okay? Now, let's get on to this week's episode. Welcome back to Restorative Grief with Mandy Capehart. You are listening to a bonus episode titled Committed to Wholeness with Trey Ferguson. Hello, grievers and friends. This is a special bonus episode featuring my friend and soon-to-be-published author, Trey Ferguson. His new work, Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy, is coming out on January 16th. And so this was the perfect time to release a conversation that we actually recorded nearly a year ago for an entirely different podcast. For those of you in the know, I hosted a faith-based podcast for a few years, and when that project came to an end, this beautiful conversation still needed a home. So today I'm talking with Trey about the heart of his work, which is inviting us into the messy space of curiosity and wonder when it comes to our faith practices. I recently heard from some of you that you wanted more faith-based conversations in the grief world on the show. So consider this step one and practice listening for any ideas from Trey's work that you might bring into your own grief experience. Trey Ferguson, you are this beautiful writer and speaker. You're a pastor, and you have a book coming out. And I'm so grateful to have you here with us today.
Oh man, you're far too kind. I'm so glad that you guys are having me here. I'm excited about this. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, it's an honor to hold space for you because you are, like I said, you're working on this beautiful book called Theologizing Bigger. Will you just start us off by telling us a little bit about the book? Because I think it really encapsulates the beauty of who you are and how you show up in your work.
Yeah, most definitely. I think when it comes to life in general and matters of faith in particular, we're often formed a lot more by our own experiences and our own enclaves than a lot of us realize, right? And as the world shrinks around us because of technology, or I guess technically it's expanding, but we come in contact with other people and their experiences. Sometimes it's a jarring thing to go through when all of a sudden what you assume to be true for everyone, you recognize is not necessarily true. And it's this dissonance that goes along there, right? And my answer, my theory, and how to deal with this paradigm shifting around us is that we have to theologize bigger, right? When I talk about theologizing, I'm talking about like the thoughts that we think about God and how we view matters of spirituality and faith. And right now we have this opportunity because of all of the people and the ideas that we can come in contact with to think bigger thoughts about God. There's this what I would describe as a liberative ethic in holding our presuppositions a little more loosely and our own experiences more loosely as we make space and room for the stories and experiences of other people and find out that God's plan and God's redemption and God's love is so much bigger than we ever imagined before, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you and I met on Twitter, and so this is a perfect example, right? We have been exposed to this experience of faith practices that are so much more expansive than what we may have understood previously to be true, or that we may have had some certainty about, which in and of itself, certainty can be so reckless, right, and dismissive of other experiences. And so I'm curious, like, how have you in your own time online, how have you seen the positives and the negatives of that exposure to new practices and new ways of showing up in our faith? How has that affected the way you show up and the way that you pastor others?
Yeah, I think for me, I've really been honing in on this idea of trusting people to be reliable narrators of their own experience, right? And what that means is when I dialogue with somebody, whether that's online or in person now, and I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, online is not real life. Like, no, this is sometimes the best opportunity I have to interact with people who live very different lives than me, right? Like, I don't want people to think I'm more worldly than I am. I live a life where I'm around very similar people and stuff like that. But when I have an opportunity to speak with somebody who's experienced life differently than me, I have to trust that they're telling me the truth about what they're seeing and what they're going through, even if it's completely foreign to my own experience, right? But as that happens and as I try to embody that ethic, I also have to acknowledge the fact that some of the same ways of being that we've embodied, where we hold to certainty, and sometimes this level of arrogance, right, where we feel as though we have this monopoly on whatever the proper interpretation of life and experience is, right? We can sometimes bring that into the new spaces as we let other people's experiences inform our own. So then we think, like, as we're expanding, like, okay, now I really have it, right? Whereas I think when you lean into trusting people to be reliable narrators of their own experiences, it can lead you to a place of humility where you're like, you know what? I don't have these answers, and I'm only going to grow closer to them in community with other people. Sometimes we bring this ethos, this way of thinking from our own communities to, we now believe that we can be narrators of other people's experiences just because we sat with them for a few moments, right? So yeah. There's this tension of always trying to make sure that we keep the arrogance of certainty at bay and at arm's length as we lean into the community with other people.
The arrogance of certainty at bay. Yeah.
That was pretty good, right? There's just came up with that, like, on the spot, like, just
so
now.
It's so good.
Was off the cuff. I mean, yeah.
You need to coin it and get it on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And create on a blurb, because you're right. There's a lot of social responsibility in choosing to have a faith conversation with a relative stranger.
Right. And it was pretty awkward for me because at first, I would say it was awkward at first because I like this theme that you guys are going with in terms of curiosity, and that's naturally me. And I think that catches some people off guard because I am known and first registered as a pastor in some people's minds. And that's my own fault, right? Like, Pastor Trail 5 is all over. It's my website and social media handles, all that stuff. So yeah, I can't be mad at you for thinking of me as a pastor, but some people have tied that to somebody who operates and moves in certainty, right? And that's never really been the way I approach ministry. I approach God and ministry and leading other people with a healthy dose of curiosity and questions. And sometimes I'm fine with not finding the answers to those questions. I don't know is one of my favorite answers, right? When I'm having dialogues with perfect strangers about faith, I answer a lot of those conversations not sure of whether or not I will be met with the same curiosity that I'm approaching the conversation with. And it's kind of grating at times, right? Because I'll ask clarifying questions and things, and people I found are very comfortable telling me about what I believe or what I ought to believe. Or, and I'm like, oh, you're skipping a bunch of steps here, because there's a whole lot that you don't know about me or my life or how I've come to faith or the faith that I need to survive in this life that I live. So it's always an interesting place to navigate. But, you know, when you lean into it, you learn a lot about communication. And I think one of the more concrete examples I can give that's really helped me in a major way is I've been dialoguing with a lot more Jewish people in the Twitter space in specific, like, we're talking about social media. And hearing people, particularly people who are very open and vocal about the problems of Christian interpretation and how those have played out throughout history and with Jewish people. And right now we're recording this during Holy Week, which is a very difficult time for Jewish people throughout history and even presently. And that's been a place where I've been able to stretch myself theologically and how I interact with the stories of the Bible, and really owning the fact that Christians as a whole are borrowing, sometimes appropriating, the stories of a whole nother people, right? And so there's times when I'm preparing to teach through a Bible study series or preach a sermon, and I'm looking at how I'm interacting with the text, and there's a few people, I won't name drop them here or whatever, that sometimes I'll shoot them a DM and I'm like, hey, like, how is this sitting with you? Like, does this make any sense? Because at the end of the day, like, I'm dealing with the very real stories of a people who interact with and hold these stories in fundamentally different ways than most Christians, including myself, would. And I think having those interactions, and not for the sake of trying to convince them of approaching these texts with a Christological lens, or not with the goal of converting them to Christianity, but okay, how has this story set with you and your community over time and in the present, has given me a fuller understanding and a fuller context of these stories in ways that are deeply humbling and have definitely impacted the way that I minister, like even when I leave the Twitter sphere, you know? And for the simple fact that a lot of times when we talk about converting people, the question that goes unasked a lot of times is to what exactly? Because we clearly, like, most people are like, oh, to Christianity, to Christ, to belief. And I, like, okay, if we look at all of the different aspects of my identity, there's lots of aspects of historic Christianity that trouble me as a Black man in the United States of America, right? So there's times when, oh, somebody got saved and everybody wants to celebrate. And I'm like, wait, saved to what? Where are they going? Because I don't know if I'm ready to celebrate that just yet. And I say stuff like that, it makes people uncomfortable, but I have to be honest about the fact that, this is part of my lived experience. Every sort of Christianity ain't been good for me and my people, you know?
Yeah.
So
I think that that's brilliant to bring to the table, simply because that allows for a spectrum,
right?
And that allows for this growth process in our faith to then say, no, there is no arrival. Because that's, I think, where we've tripped for so long, and probably what you've experienced on the flip side, recognizing how allowing ourselves to believe on a growth pattern or a growth trajectory with that intention of expansion over time and inclusion of more understanding and of more effective theology has really led us both down bend towards social justice as well. And I struggle a lot with conversations about faith on Twitter because, one, of course, there's no nuance. It's really easy to read someone's statement and then conclude, oh, so you hate children because of some, like, man, kids are noisy. Oh, you want all children to be quiet and dead? Wow, you're a nice Christian. Like, those make me so internally inflamed. I just am like, I got to shut all the technology down today.
Yeah.
But there are still so many valuable conversations to be had. So I guess my question is really, how do you maintain internal integrity and really soften toward people who are, as you love to say, and I love this, saying something with their whole chest and, like, honestly believing the nonsense that is so dismissive and diminutive? How do you still approach that, knowing, like, hey, this isn't my circus, these aren't my monkeys, but at the same time, I want to show up again in my integrity and extend grace in a way that can actually make an impact, rather than just being like, okay, well, this is just another person I'm going to call names on the internet and walk away from. Like, how do you decide?
Yeah. So a lot of it is just drinking my water and minding my business, right? I gotta learn that every fight ain't for me to hop into. I can't tussle everywhere. And then there's a few other things that I try to maintain an ethic about. Like, I don't try to do a whole lot of the quote tweet wars and stuff like that. There are times when I will very vehemently disagree with somebody on Twitter. And typically what I try to do is I try to keep it in the replies, right? There's a reply feature for a reason, and that invites dialogue. If this person wants to push back, or then we can do that there. And I've done that plenty of times. And sometimes we come to a point of agreement. Sometimes we agree to disagree. But if there's ever a time where I feel like somebody's off on some path that warrants a larger discussion, right? I have this one policy. Some people, well, why do you always do that? Well, I'll screenshot their tweet and take their name out, because I always want it made clear that I'm not attacking a person, right? What I am doing is dealing with an idea that I might disagree with. And So, of course, there's some people who are over aggressive. They'll search the text and find the person anyway. I can't solve everything. I'm not Jesus. I can't save the sins of the world. But what I do want to do is try to steer people away from the pile-on culture, right? And just beating up on people. And let's deal with this idea and how this is impacting us. Because if we want to get spiritual and everything, like, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and everything. So, okay, what is it that I'm taking issue? Because at the end of the day, one of the things about me is I don't take none of this stuff personally. For simple fact, y'all don't know me, right? Like, people know what I put out about me. And if there's something I put out, then cool, it's fine. But some people want to make stuff more personal than it is. And I'm like, this is not possible. And of course, I share a lot. I used to tweet a lot more than I do currently because I try to save some stuff for a book I have to write. But at the same time, understanding that, like, this isn't really personal, and it shouldn't have to be that way. So when I do try to enter into dialogue with people and everything, we lean into curiosity and we ask more questions than answers given when possible. Sometimes me speaking about things in this way will shock some people, because there are times when I might come across as a little brash, right? A little stronger. And some of that is simply a matter of being confident in who I am. So there are times when I am not met with curiosity and people presume that they're in a position to educate me or set me straight or something. I'm like, oh no, I got the letters behind my name. I could do this. We could do, I'm not shooting from the hip. I know what I'm talking about. Right. And so I think in striking a balance of doing the work to educate myself while also meeting people with curiosity helps me to kind of keep a level head. And that's not to say I'm perfect. There's times when I slip up and people be like, I didn't really appreciate the way this went. And I try to own that when it's like, yo, I'm not perfect and I messed up here. I didn't do right by you. Matter of fact, it happened recently where I messed up and I was like, yo, I'm gonna make sure that the apology is as loud as the disrespect was or whatever. Because perfection is never my goal. Safety and community is what it's about for me. So I try to lean into the spaces that I do not understand. Because, of course, we all have blind spots, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's about making room for the fact that I do have those blind spots, letting other people, giving other people permission to hold me accountable to those blind spots and growing in areas while still letting my voice sound where it should.
So talk to me then about how your book is making space for those blind spots, for the conversations where you remain curious, where you are creating openness and opportunity for wonder in a way that invites people in. So, like, take us through what the book is going to be about.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm thinking through that because I had a subtitle in mind that I'm probably going to tweak just because I wanted to land the right way. But my whole, like, premise, if the premise is, like, a lot of us start somewhere and a lot of times we're in essence kind of limited by where we're starting, by the traditions that we inherit or where we step into, and that there is more to faith and life in general than our experiences will lead us to on their own. What I'm trying to lead people to and what I'm trying to convey in this book is that there is not only liberation and liberty and thinking outside of our own paradigms and leaning into community, but that we have the opportunity to grow a fuller understanding of who God is and what God is capable of doing in our lives, even if it's just a couple of steps out of the comfort of our own tradition, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole idea is a lot of times theology is an endeavor. Well, not a lot of times. It is chiefly an endeavor in imagination, right? Like, we're all dealing with a God that we cannot see. Mm-hmm. We have to put these images together in our mind. That's how this works. And a lot of times the images that we construct are shaped by the lives that we and the people directly around us have lived. Yeah, my main point here is, okay, what if we step outside? What if we invite more people to that table? What would that image of God that we've constructed look? What would happen to that image of God? And my argument is that it becomes bigger and leads us to places beyond our wildest imagination. And that those places are, in fact, good, not only for ourselves, but for society and creation as a whole.
Oh, I just want to sit with that for a while. So I think primarily because I remember in my own younger self, like adult, but younger self in the church, trying to say something similar and trying to expand beyond the, okay, you've distilled this passage down for me as my Sunday morning pastor, and this is your conclusion. That doesn't sit right with me, but I'm trying to form my own sense of autonomy and faith practice while also having someone I listen to and interpret from. But in my mind, my imagination says God is so much bigger than a 3-point sermon. How can you even deign to say that you've concluded anything after reading scripture? Like for myself, I found so many, well, what about this? And what about that? And it, with a hopeful anticipation of the answer, right? Whether there was an answer or not, not with a, well, what about this scripture that says the opposite, but approaching it with that kind of a sense of imagination and curiosity and wonder. And so I guess I want to ask, how would you invite, like maybe my younger self, but also people I know that are in the same boat, having a lot of inputs and wanting to recapture a sense of wonder when in the last decade, what their faith has been really forced into is something that is very maybe black and white, or very forced to take a strict stand because they've been taught, if you don't know what you stand for, then you'll fall for anything. And how can you say you're a Christian if you have no, like, you don't agree with the Nicene Creed or something, you know, those older tenets that we maybe, I mean, I was raised Lutheran, so I grew up saying a lot of those liturgical things.
Yeah. But I think first and foremost, and I say this, I've said it before, you got to get comfortable being called a heretic, first and foremost. I think if you're doing this faith journey correctly, not correctly, if you're leaning into this thing and leaning into that sense of wonder, somebody's going to do it eventually. Somebody's going to call you a heretic, and you got to get comfortable with that happening a few times. Now, if everybody's calling you a heretic, maybe that's something else different. But I think it was Bishop Yvette Flunder who once said, the difference between a heretic and a prophet is time. Right. So that's one thing. You have to get comfortable with some people being uncomfortable with where you might be headed or with questions that you're asking or the things that you're exploring. The other thing to wrestle with there is trying to unpack at what point in our journey we picked up this idea of certainty being a virtue. Because at the end of the day, as I understand it, faith and certainty are often in opposition to each other. If faith is the evidence of things unseen, that means that faith is counting on you leaning into something that is incomprehensible apart from our own imagination. We must first be able to imagine what we are trusting in, like we're leaning into by faith. That's how that works. And the thing about this is that God, when we're looking at examples of faith in the Bible, God calls people out of the comfortable spaces and out of the communities. God calls Abraham away from the safety of Ur and the Chaldeans, right? God calls Abraham into the wilderness, or Abram at the time, into the wilderness to a land that he does not know. The same land that he leads the Hebrew people out of, the only land that they had known in Egypt, and through the wilderness to a land that they will not know, right? A lot of this faith journey is predicated upon leaving the place of your comfort, the place where you know the answers, where you know where the provision is coming from, and going through a place of uncertainty, going through a wilderness where the only thing that you have to rely on is the character and the promises of God. And so the question then becomes, is our faith in the doctrines of God, is our faith in the creeds, is our faith in the teachings and the interpretations that we've always held near and dear, or is our faith in the character and the promises of God? And then the next question is, what is that character? What are those promises? And that's where the imagination comes into play. We have to think of, like, who or what is God to us? And that's something that I've literally had to take a beat and define for myself. Okay, if God is love, what is love? I boil that down to love is a commitment to wholeness, meaning that God is the commitment. God is committed to my wholeness, seeing me in the best form possible, not just me individually, but us communally. Like, God is in the business of binding those things together and seeing them thrive. Creation is an extension and an act of that love, where everything is supposed to like jive together and everything, right? And so all that to say, when it comes to like, what do we do with all of the things that we've inherited, and all if God is love, and if God is as faithful and as dependable as our scriptures point to God being, and as the God that I've imagined is, then I'm going to be okay, even if I leave the safety and the comfort and go to the wilderness to find out more about the character of God. Because the wilderness is always where people find out more about the character of God, right? And that's what it is to me, being comfortable, getting comfortable being called a heretic as you drift wherever you are, but then trusting enough in the character of God that you believe that God will meet you even outside of the familiar places, and that your faith would grow stronger because of the journey you've taken.
That's so beautiful, Trey. The other day I was reminded that like a year ago, I realized something very similar along heresy, right? Saying, I'm a heretic to somebody. Everybody is a heretic to somebody.
Absolutely.
So if that's true, and that person just hasn't met me and called me that name yet, then what am I waiting for? It's not like it's a badge of honor getting called a heretic. It's just in my opinion, someone else's fear and self-protection lashing out to keep them safe from whatever you're presenting and how it might affect them and their faith practices.
Absolutely. Sometimes heretic is just the label we give somebody who is at a different stage of imagining God than we are, right? Because there are times, yeah, even somebody got upset and accused me of teetering with blasphemy because I tweak the language that people are typically used to in terms of God ordaining the cross for Jesus. To be clear, there are scriptures that imply that. And I was like, yeah, okay, that's a theological language to a grotesque thing that occurred where somebody was executed by the Roman state. If we believe that that was God's idea, God's desire the whole time, then the inescapable conclusion is that our God is a sadist, right? So if I say that, I'm like, well, we have to think about what these things mean. Now, if I say that to somebody, I sound like a heretic to somebody, but to most human beings, that is an accurate description of what somebody requiring somebody to go through that level of excruciating torture, like, no, that's sadistic. Again, you got to get comfortable being called a heretic sometimes if you're going to lean into this journey of trying to theologize a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I love that, because recently, I don't remember who it was. It might have been Pete Enns shared an article about like 7 or 8 different atonement theories. And personally, I've been trying to I threw out penal substitutionary atonement. I'm pretty sure when I was a kid, because it never really felt good, kind of to what you're saying. And I recently brought it up at a dinner party because I'm a glutton for chaos, I guess. And my husband looked over and he goes, "You're just going to say that right now over dinner." Okay. Okay. And our friends that were across the table just looked and they said, "That's really interesting. Why?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't have any answers. Why? I just have questions."
Yes.
And I have not put enough time, not that I think I will ever put enough time into finding an answer, but I haven't put enough time into saying why. I just have a lot of questions about it. And I'm curious if maybe you have questions about it too. And it opened this beautiful conversation, because these were, you could call them elders in our family, in our community, right? People who I've looked up to, who have taught me before, about on scriptures, who I've followed for 20 some odd years in faith practice. And I just said, "Hey, can you unravel this core tenet of what people have told me Christianity is over tacos? That would be super great." And it became this really beautiful moment of true community. It felt like two or more gathered, right? Yeah. It was that moment of just genuine intimacy and character and the characteristics of a church community that I'm hungry for, that I want. I don't necessarily need someone else to read it and interpret it for me. I need someone else to do it for themselves so that I can do it for myself, so we can compare and see what shakes loose and what else could come to the surface.
Yeah, I love that wholeheartedly. Recently, partly out of necessity and then partly out of opportunity, my church, we kind of changed the way that we do Bible study, our midweek Bible study, to the point where there's still somebody leading it for the most part, but it's a lot less didactic and more of a conversation, to the point where now we regularly have, we'll open up the floor and people will have different interpretations and we'll put them in conversation with each other. And sometimes there's pushback. I'm like, well, no, this presents a problem because if that's the case, then this, what do we do with this information here? And it's one of those things, I guess some of the more theologically nerdy people will call it the Berean approach or whatever, but it does something to your faith when you feel empowered to speak on what you are experiencing as you wrestle with a text, as opposed to always having it broken down and fed to you. And I don't mean to say that as like a criticism for having people present the text to you, but I think that there is a level of maturity that we should strive towards when we can put those things in the conversation with each other. And I think that's a it's an amazing thing, a fruitful thing that happens in community when we can approach this that way together. When the voice becomes a little more democratized, for lack of a better word, when you don't feel like you have to check yourself at the door, right? That's how you make somebody feel valued. That's what belonging looks like. When, wait, no, I'm seeing this. Is there room for me too? Yes, there is. Let me hear from you.
Yeah, I love that. I want to address something too, because I mean, obviously, we're women and you're a black man. We both have had to fight for an opportunity to let our voices matter, to speak. And historically, I've been involved in churches where women have been pastors. And so I've seen and been had that modeled for me. But it doesn't mean that I've been given an opportunity for my voice to necessarily be heard where I feel like it needs to be heard. And I'm sure that's true for you too, in so many ways. And so I want to just address that, because I think we, as much as I want to believe that we're in the majority of people's experience now, and I just don't think that's true. How do we encourage people who are not used to seeing themselves reflected?
That's always an interesting question. And another one of the reasons I felt compelled to write this book is because I've been doing a whole lot of wrestling with this topic. And I think what is as responsible as anything else for this whole trend towards questioning a lot of things, and some people call it deconstruction, some people call it disentangling. Shout out to Kate Wood for that one.
Yes,
But
Kate.
one of the things that I think is spurring that is the reality of technology, the smartphone in particular, right? And I draw that comparison because I don't think the Protestant Reformation would have happened as we know it without the advent of the printing press. The idea that ideas could then be shared so much more quickly and a bit more cheaply, like more accessible, change the world in fundamental ways. Like a lot of ideas were shared that way. And I don't know if the ideas of Martin Luther or any of the other reformers would have landed the way they did had they not been able to be disseminated in that way. So access to information provided a lot of that change, and a lot of that change wasn't reforming the Catholic Church as Martin Luther wanted. It was starting new things, opening new areas of ministry and of community and of life, right? And I think we're seeing a similar thing happen in our own time with the smartphone, where the church is no longer the only arbiter of not only the truth, but even the gospel message. Like our own church communities do not have a monopoly on our attention and the information that we're accessing in the way that they would have 50 years ago or even 30 years ago. So a lot of that, like social media, is shrinking the world. We have access to all this information. And I say all of that to say that even though we might want to try to reform certain communities that we've belonged to and everything, sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes the change that we wish to see or feel called to make will not be accepted in those communities. And it's a matter of building new communities and setting new tables and things of that nature. And it's both an unfortunate reality in that, like, no, sometimes, like, why can't we just be better where we are? But also a great opportunity in that the role of the gatekeeper has been greatly diminished. We can just build new tables. where we get to decide what the voices look like, right? Like there are times now in certain speaking engagements, I get to ask, okay, who all gonna be there? And if I don't like the list, Trey not gonna show up either. Because I don't like what, like, yeah, you've gone out of your way to construct this at this point. Like, I don't want to do that. And so for me, a lot of it is like the Three Black Men podcast is an example of that. We're like, wow, a lot of the topics we hear seeing discussed out here are kind of toxic. Like this is sort of depressing. Well, why don't we do something different? Cool, let's do that. And there's nobody stopping us, right? So sometimes it's just a matter of knowing when to hold them and knowing when to fold them. When do we stop shouting into the void and begin getting our hands dirty and building something new? And then determining what success looks like in that regard. Because if we use the same metrics that we used in the old communities, we're always going to feel like a failure. But if our goal is just the newness of safety and of valuing the voices around the table, then we get to determine our own metrics. Like maybe if it's just me having a safe space, maybe it's just a group chat with these people where we commiserate on these things. Maybe it's the podcast here. Maybe it's a blog. Maybe it is me learning something new in this regard. Like I don't want to put limits on what that needs to look like, but it's never been easier for us to build new tables, right? I don't think the data we have on the decline of church numbers is telling the full story or the story that the church has been telling about religion being in decline. I think a lot of it is about the fact that like there's so many other ways to learn now and people are recognizing like, oh, I can do this in a different way. I think that good stewardship of our resources and our expertise demands that we find out ways to be creative in the needs that we see springing up in our communities, you know?
Yeah. I do. I love that. And I think too, even the way that we've defined religion and spirituality in the past is not indicative of how what we would call it today. And I really love, we ended last season and I was reading a book by Rob Bell called Everything is Spiritual. And it reminds me exactly of that. And I said it then, and I'll just say it again, because I've loved pushing back when someone calls a thing secular. Because to me, that is so limiting. And if I'm going to believe in an ever expansive, imaginative, creative, all encompassing God, how could I ever think for a second that something is outside of their purview or their influence or their ability to create and manifest something new? And I think that goes along with what you're saying too. You're right. It is now we have that access to people in ways that we never have. It's not necessarily as hard as it was to make friends when we were, right, you know, 15 years ago when it was, you know, we were out of college and out of whatever. And everybody said, it's really hard to make friends as a grown up. I'm like, it is, but also you have access now to people that you never had access to before. So maybe your friends are just waiting and they live somewhere else. Yeah.
Most definitely. I think at its core, religion is essentially the stories, the signs and the people that we ascribe significance to, right? So whether or not we do that in what we would recognize as an organized fashion or not, I think everybody is participating in, like, people are driven by stories. And even if you do leave organized religion or you denounce the religion of your youth, there's always another story that springs up and to take its place. Like we have to find something new to do with the story that we inherited. And a lot of times it's replaced by another one. So even if you are a secular or non-religious person, there's a civic story or a sociological story that we have to ascribe significance to. And a lot of times we're doing that multiple times. So like people say, oh, the 1619 Project is unbiblical. Yeah, why would it be biblical? There's nothing, it's two different spheres of life, but does it ring true? Is the actual question there. And I say all of that to say that one of the reasons that I think we're seeing this decline in religious identity or overtly religious identity is that as we come in contact with other people's stories and recognize the truth and the validity of their experience, even as it differs from our own, it is a little jarring to some people to recognize, oh, wow, the stories that I had ascribed ultimate significance to do not tell the complete story of the world around me. Yes. And I think that's like to the point about leaning into things curiously and everything. I think that that's a good thing. The more we understand about the world around us, the more we are on the path to understanding the totality of the love and the peace and that God has for creation and the wholeness that God is calling us to. I think that when we shy away from that, we're actually cutting God off a little bit. We're kind of keeping God at a bit of a distance when we fail to take advantage of opportunities to understand more about the fullness of what God has created around us.
Oh my gosh, that's like the most beautiful moment to just rest with for a second. And I think that's perfect. Trey, you've given me hope again, and just a reminder that all these questions we keep asking are not chaotic questions, or if they are, they're good chaos, and that's invited and important. So thank you.
I love it. Ain't nothing wrong with chaos, because sometimes God hovers over the chaos, and that's where God starts creating that. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. It's so funny. My daughter and I will freak out my husband by just whispering chaos every now and then because we're chaotic and playful. But thank you for saying that, because yeah, I mean, it's my, you know, young upbringing goes back to that. Well, God is a God of order and not disorder, you know, like the little background noise saying that's not true. That's not true. And it is true. Dang it.
Yeah.
Do you have any, what's your last thought? Is there anything else you want to, you know, we've got your book coming out and you have two podcasts, Living Translation and the Three Black Men podcast. We'll put all of that in the show notes as well for you. But what do you want to go out on?
God is committed to your wholeness. That's it.
I love it. It's perfect. I accept. Thank you, God. And thank you. Thank you, Trey, for being here.
Thank you all for having me.
Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of Restorative Grief. I love how Trey gently and confidently challenges the narrative of certainty in a faith practice because, as you well know, the myth of certainty has certainly derailed most of us in our search for healing. Grief work and faith exploration are not so different. Some might even say they are intimately intertwined. So if you found yourself reflecting on your own spirituality or maybe asking some new questions about what you believe or what might be possible for you in your own faith journey or grief process, know that you are among friends in doing so. Check out the show notes for links to Trey's book, his podcasts, and to follow him on the socials because he is a beautiful human. You need to hear more of his work. If you're interested in learning more about restorative grief, you can always come find me on the socials as well, or check out my work at mandykpart.com. And if this is your first time listening to the show, thanks for digging in and committing to your own wholeness too. And as always, before we go, please remember, the only solution for grief is to do the work of grieving. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.